Good. Ready or not, here we come. So this is, I think if I get the schedule right, the last, it's approaching on me, scary. It's okay. This is the last kind of formal talk before tomorrow morning. In the tomorrow morning, we do the wind up, the thank yous, the loving kindness meditation. There'll be a sort of a talk, but only about for half an hour, and then a guided meditation and stuff. So the last day is always a bit sort of short. So the question which people were asking me last night, which I promised I would try and answer today, was that, you know, it's very nice having all this meditation here, but how can we sort of continue this on? Or how can we reap the benefits when we go back to our work, to our job? When we go back to what people call the real world, what I keep calling the fake world. Because if you look at it, the real world, what is the real world you're talking about? Where people wear makeup, wigs, they dye their hair. I never dye my hair. And their deodorants, and you go to places where it's air-conned, and you wear so many clothes, sometimes people don't even realize what the weather is. And even big sort of condominiums where you don't even know whether it's snowing or whether it's boiling outside, and where there's no mosquitoes, you're not allowed to have snakes in your apartment, and it's not real. So, in other words, that sometimes you come to a place like this, and it is out there in the real world, and you go back there, and you have the machines, the screens, and the SMSs, and also just so much other stuff. And, you know, even I say, you know, the tablets to eat and drink and stuff, and all sorts of stuff. Are we really sort of coming to that in the real world, just where we can actually confront and be with and be kind to the reality of now? This is as real as you get. And sometimes the stuff which you put on the screens, the movies, the SMSs, is that really, you know, what what is actually real? Or is it just a little bit fake? I remember just there was this one monk years ago, a long time ago, and he told me once that he was a very nice monk, but he was just trying a bit too hard. And then, you know, he went over to the Melbourne area. It's a long time ago, so you won't know who this monk is. And he decided to, he's getting a bit lonely, so he decided to go on the advertisements for a girlfriend, for a partner. And he told me afterwards, he says, the most suffering he's ever had in his life. Because everything which was described on the pages of, you know, what this girlfriend was like, it bore no resemblance at all to what he saw when he actually got there. And, oh no. So anyway, that's just, you know, because, you know, most people do that. They always just bend, they tell people what they want to hear, they try and be something they're not, they try and live up to other people's expectations, and which means it's not real. So even this retreat centre here, yeah, we've done our best, but, you know, did it live up to your expectations? Yeah, sometimes, in some respects it did, in some respects it can't. It can never live up to everyone's expectations, because this retreat centre is imperfect. Just like the forest, just like the food. If you like the food, and if you think it's really good food here, then you're going to suffer when you have to go out and eat something else. Either way, it's never perfect, because it never lasts. So because of that, you know, this is maybe as good as you get, and what we have here is that you have, number one, a place where we can really rest. And that's one of the things which people don't get in our modern world. rest time. Even me, that sometimes when it gets to the rains retreat, everyone said, oh, the rains retreat, it's a time, you know, for rest. And I said, yes, it's my rest period. I work and the rest of the people can take a rest. Because wherever you go, you have to teach somebody. So anyway, but you learn, just, you know, to learn how to take it easy. And of course, the things we learn here, which really work out there in the world, is little things, such as that whatever you're going to face when you go out into that world, whatever work, whatever trials, whatever things you have to get done, you always remember, just now's the most important time. This thing in front of you is the most important, and the most important thing is to care. So what does that mean? Taking that back to that story so many years ago with my great teacher Ajahn Chah, who, if you have a great teacher, sometimes you hate him because he pushes your buttons. He doesn't actually give you an easy time. He just makes you just go deeper into wisdom. So that time when we were pushing those wheelbarrows of earth. And if you don't know that story, here it comes. I don't think I've heard it so many times. Listening to it is the easy part. Complaining is the hard part. So, those who don't know what we're laughing about, that story was, young monk, Ajahn Chah just finished his main hall and had all this earth left over, and he asked us, all you monks, can we just move the earth? And he didn't mind doing that because it was good karma. You know, sometimes, when we have duties and rosters, yeah, we have to do that, but sometimes it's not your duty. It's not on your roster, but you just do it anyway, just for the fun. You want to help somebody. Somebody is washing the dishes, and so you help wash them as well. Isn't that good fun? So this is actually, because you're helping, you're serving, you're doing something, which is great. So this, that kindness and that sort of service is an act of gratitude, what I could do to my teacher. So when he asked, can we all move this earth? Yeah, sure, no trouble. So, but it was much more hard work than you thought, wheelbarrows, because we only had the one meal of the day, and it was usually sticky rice and frogs. Actually, not always frogs, but sometimes we had rotten fish. Curry. So it was really malnourished. But then we were pushing these wheelbarrows through the forest, full of earth, and dumping them where Ajahn Chah wanted them. And we finished our meal, usually really in the early, went on arms round, and then we had our meal. Maybe 9 o'clock, we're all finished, and then pushing the wheelbarrows. And then we go all day until about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, when you couldn't see anymore, but you had the lanterns. And then it was too late to go for a shower, and you were too exhausted. So you just laid down and just crashed out and got up in the morning, just off on the arms round again. Because these, not showers, you just had to go to the well and just call the water out. So after about 3 days, I must have really stank. But then everyone stank, so it was all the same. So after 3 days, we finished the job. Yay! So I thought the next day I could have a nice rest and just catch up on meditation, wash my robes, and obviously, and just clean up. And just, but that night, Ajahn Chah went to another monastery. And it was Ajahn Liam was the second monk. He's now the head monk there. And he asked us, he said, I was looking at that pile of earth we just finished moving. I don't think it's in the right place. I think we should move it over there. So, move it. And in those days, the senior monks, they would just sit there and drink tea and talk to the visitors all the day. These monks like me had to do all the work. And I never became a monk to be a laborer. And anyway, there's enough money in that monastery. Why don't they get an earth mover, some electronic, I know, some equipment, and just do it properly instead of just exploiting our monks, pushing the wheelbarrows up. I still had faith. Because he had a point. I was not in the right place, and it looked better in the other place. Another 3 days of work. That's 6 days without hardly any rest. Really stinky. But then it was done. And that night, now at last I can wash my robes. And that was the night Ajahn Chah came back. And in the morning, at the lunch, or the, I did my lunch and breakfast, this one meal, and he said, I thought I told you to put the earth over there. Now you put it over here. Now just move it. And I was always a very patient monk. I had a lot of faith. But every amount of faith has its limit, and I was past it. He can't do this to us. This is just too much. Why can't the two of them just sit down and decide what they want to put the blooming earth? That's not what I said, blooming earth. But I just restrained myself just in time. So, but anyway, it's no choice. There we were, pushing these wheelbarrows again. And another 3 days of hard work. I knew what was in store for me. 3 days of hard work. And at that point, you know, there's a nice thing about just, you don't need to read minds. Just look at people's face and you find out what their mind is thinking about. And actually I was helping because I was swearing. Yeah, no, it was always in English because I always thought the Thai monks would not understand what the English meant. But you know, a few of them were ordained gone to school overseas. And so anyway, they can tell by the way I said it that I wasn't happy. And that's when this great monk, and to this day I don't know who he is, but wherever he is, you know, thank you so much. He said to me, he said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is a difficult part. And that was just one sentence like that. One little bit of Dhamma. It just helps your whole life. Doing it is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Teaching a retreat, it's easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Teaching the afternoon guided meditations is easy. You think, oh, what am I going to say? Are they going to like it? They're not going to like it. Oh my goodness, what happened? Well. What happens if I make a mistake? What happens if? Doing it is easy. Even things in life like dying. You know, dying is easy. You've done it many times. Thinking about it's the hard part. And so much in life is like that. So I try and sort of think as least as possible and just do it. And you find in meditation it's easy. Start thinking about it. Sitting for an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours. Just watching the breath. If you think about it, it's really difficult. I will now prove that to you with this little exercise. Now you don't need to change your posture, okay? Just close your eyes and watch 3 breaths. In, out, 3 times. And after the 3rd breath, open your eyes, but keep breathing. Was that easy? To watch your breath? Okay, now, don't change your posture, close your eyes, now watch 3,000 breaths. In, out, in. Why are you laughing? Okay, you can open your eyes. It just, what's the difference? Watching 3 breaths, you can only watch the breath happening now anyway. So what's the difference between 3,000? 3,000, we're thinking about it. Oh my goodness, that's too much, that's too long, how can I ever do that? So much of life is like that. Even all these monasteries, jhana grove, which, you know, I was involved in building. It always ever was just one brick at a time. Just lay this brick and then see what's happened tomorrow. It's always just, you know, one talk at a time and then see what happens next. So you never sort of worry too much about the future. Even actually giving talks. The first time I started giving talks, I remember going to Nolamara one evening and just going around the back and seeing just how many people were actually in that hall waiting to listen to me. I thought, oh my goodness, what if I screw up? What if I make a mess? What if I and people don't want to go and hear Buddhism anymore, and I've turned so many people away from the Dhamma, and I was just with really bad karma because all these people, they came and wanted to learn meditation, and I just said something so terrible that they'll never come and learn meditation ever again until the next six lifetimes. And what bad karma have I done? So shut up. So don't think about it. Just do it. Anyway, in life, hopefully you heard from here what you've been trained, what works in meditation. You just look at the future with a positive mind. Looking at it with a negative mind is where you've got fear, anxiety. What will happen if, followed by something negative? And instead you think, what would happen if, with something positive? So I started thinking when I was walking in there, I was thinking, hey, you know, it's not a bad idea if I stuff up. Because if I get stuff up and people don't like it, there's many other teachers around, then I can have a nice, easy life. I can just sit around the back and just look after other monks, and I won't get invited in to go overseas. I'll just be able to sit in my cave and have a nice, happy, peaceful life, just like a Pacheka Buddha, you know, just like somebody who doesn't teach. You sit there and just, enjoy myself. And I thought it would be even better. But I made a big mistake on that talk. I gave a good talk. That's my mistake, and so I got invited back again. Now look at me. So you have a little bit of fun with what you're doing. Putting fun into the meditation. And that was happening when I was moving those wheelbarrows. I put fun into it. And yeah, we would have races. Recently, I think when I did go to Vietnam for one of these United Nations Day of Vaisak. And you don't just go give talks all the time. They take you to, I'm afraid this is the case, they take you to sightseeing. And you've got no choice. You say, in the bus, off you go. The only way you can get out of that is if you pretend to be sick. So I'm sick of sightseeing. So that's not the sickness we mean. So in the bus. But anyway, when you have to do these things, it was, I forget these, it's actually very beautiful, these caves and these lakes which go, I don't know, it's in the middle of Vietnam somewhere, I forget where it was. But anyway, after a while, the guys they hired to row these boats is getting tired. So, you know, we're compassionate. I'm a compassionate monk, so I'll have a go. I'll sort of do some exercise and paddle the boat. And then I saw that there was another monk I knew, a Singaporean Mahayana monk. He was in another boat. We were next to each other, and I had one paddle. He had a paddle in the other boat, and I said, right, let's decide once and for all. Theravada or Mahayana? Who's really got it? And Mark gets it, goes, I've been paddling away. Theravada versus Mahayana. And so in the end, you know what happened? Theravada won. And I said, of course, because we're bodhisattvas. You win first. Of course we'll let you go in there first. So that's just how, when, you know, you learn to have fun with whatever you're doing. And that means that, yeah, I would rather just stay in a room somewhere and meditate, but there you go, you've got no choice, so you make the best of it. Now, that's where we don't have the fault-finding mind, the complaining mind. And that's what you're learning here. Did you always have great meditations on last week? Everyone, beautiful. Of course, that's impossible. I told so many people in the interviews, and I probably told you here, but I keep forgetting what I said yesterday, what I said in interviews, what I said when I was in Bodhinyana Monastery. You give so many talks all over the place. I don't know which talk was given first and last and in between. But anyway, so here it comes again. It was the story of the refugee. No, it's great having refugees come into Australia. And I don't know if you know this story. There was a Vietnamese refugee years ago. And he came in the boat. And he managed to actually make it to the Australia, our West Australia coast, and with a few others. And there were just no clothes, no money, it had all been robbed. And just dehydrated, just relieved to actually to find land where many others had actually perished at sea. And as they came in to the shore, you know, not knowing what they might find, that's when they saw two Australian fishermen. And these two fishermen saw these emaciated refugees. And what they did was shout at them, "Welcome to Australia, mate! Have a beer!" And those refugees remembered that. And especially one of those refugees, that was his welcome to Australia. Friendliness, but at least it was, "Welcome, have a beer." And he's currently the governor of South Australia. Did really well in life. And that's what you know, when you welcome people, who knows what they're going to turn out like. So it's a wonderful little story. But anyway, sometimes the refugees are not treated all that well. At least they're not, they think they're not treated well, as in this case, because this fellow, he was highly educated, but the only job he could get was on a building site. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he worked so hard. Actually, that reminds me of me when I came over here. I was highly educated, and I spent my early years working on a building site in Bonnyon Monastery. Anyway, just after 3 days, came home every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. "How did you do?" I said, "I worked really hard." "How much did you earn?" "Nothing." "They didn't pay me at all." "Thursday, the same." No, Australian people, they just exploit. They exploit migrants. They don't treat us fairly. 4 days I worked really hard, I got nothing, nothing at all. And his wife said, "Well, you might as well go to work on Friday, waste of time being here." So he went there, hardly did much work at all. And his boss gave him this big pay packet. And he said, "I realise now how things work in Australia. You only go to work on Fridays." "I'm staying at home Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday." Because we always want sort of the best. We want to be paid every day. We want to have a good meditation, every meditation. We have one meditation, "Yeah, I know how to do it now," the next meditation is terrible. It's just learning. Just even in meditation, we're building up the karma. In life, we're building up the karma. And sometimes we have to go through some painful experiences, some very difficult experiences. And where's the pay packet? We keep pushing, learning, whatever it is we're trying to do. But the pay packet always comes eventually. People sometimes doubt that, but look back in your life. When you're right in the middle of the poo, of course, it's difficult to see any way out. But then eventually, you know, from that poo, that you find out that amazing things grow, and you learn. And sometimes the suffering of life is suffering, but it's not always suffering. Suffering, and we grow from it, we learn from it, we develop from it, it's called growing pains. And then when we do get through it, sometimes we get heedless, just like that, what was it, that bird? That bird who left it too late to migrate. And so it was on the tree, and the cold spell came unexpectedly, just like the cold spell that came on the first part of this retreat. It was unseasonably cold, very quickly, that's hot again. So anyway, a bird was on a tree, and it got so cold, it got hypothermia, fell off the tree, and was just laying on the ground thinking it's going to die. Really, really bad luck. But then fortune turns so quickly. A cow came past. Has anyone ever seen our cow yet? You have seen it. Can you please tell it not to poo all over the place? Because this is what happened to this little bird. You know, if somebody thought, such bad luck, if one more thing can go wrong, you know, what would it be? And of course, the cow went right over it and pooed right on top of the bird. Imagine that, a tiny bird, and you get covered in cow poo. But the cow poo was warm and thawed the bird out. Oh, what good fortune! And so it poked its head out, alive again, and started tweeting with joy. At which point that alerted there was a big eagle above, and the eagle saw it was a bird there, and that was the end of the bird. And so, this was told to me by Nibuto, the other one yesterday. So I blame him for this one. And so the eagle ate the bird. And the bird went right through the eagle, and when the eagle was high up in the air, the little bird poked its head out of the back side of the eagle. It's still alive. Really tough little bird. And the little bird shouted at the eagle, "Hey, how high are we?" And the eagle said, "Oh, about 2,000 feet. And the bird replied, "No shit, please." Okay. Some people are holding their head in despair. Anyway. Anyway, so sometimes bad things happen, then good things happen, then bad things happen, then good things happen. You don't know the course of events in our life. But in the end, just we manage to learn so much, sort of in our life. And that's what we learn here. It's almost like this is like a laboratory, where we're learning how to deal with our body and our mind, two very important things. Our own body and mind, first of all. Get to know how our body works and then how our mind works and see how they interact together. In particular, just how to be healthy and even if you're sick, how to be at peace with sickness and just how to learn just to be kind to this body, to learn how this body works. Because sometimes, you know, that people who are doctors, they know all the theory, but actually just doing it, being with it. And even simple things that, which I really like to sort of share with anyone in medical profession, that the idea that every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling in the body. It's manifested in the body somewhere. Fear has got a particular type of sensation, physical feeling. And there's a lot of time that, you know, we're not so clear what the fear is, but sometimes you know the tightness and the tension in a certain part of our body. When we're in love, there's another type of feeling in the body. When we're afraid, another, excited. And sometimes in order to get to know our mind, that mental world, we can actually see how it's manifested in our bodily feelings. And that is actually very useful, because many of the problems which we have in our body, just their origin is just with some mental emotion somewhere. That's one of the reasons why, you know, some people, that they have these problems in their life or problems in their body, and they go to sort of these regression therapies. They take them back to supposed past life, if it's a past life or not. The catharsis happens and they don't seem to have that problem anymore. This is a very interesting story about the the girl who had anorexia. Now the physical problem, why? Anorexia, why? Naturally, that just, when I try to find out what does anorexia mean, I looked in the dictionary, you know, the dictionary of anorexia. And the dictionary was only a small dictionary, but I thought, wow, that's so interesting, because what I read as anorexia is one of the major symptoms is you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. And I said, wow, that's me. I'm fairly found out. Well, it's true, I look in the mirror. But no, it's a serious complaint or sickness or whatever. So anyway, but what they found out was no one actually could seem to cure this girl or help her in any which way. So what they did was to try regression therapy. And because she was, I think, young, about 16 or something, and according to Australian law, you had to have the mother with her because it was a male psychologist, and they regressed her in the presence of her mum. And she remembered a previous life where she was the younger of two sisters who both fell in love with the same man. And even though they loved each other as sisters, you know, the fighting over the same guy was just, you know, really serious stuff. So serious that when the guy chose the elder sister, because she was more attractive, more beautiful, then the younger sister was so heartbroken that she committed suicide. And she said, that was me in my past life. My previous life, I was so heartbroken that the guy I loved fell in love with my elder sister that I couldn't stand it, so I committed suicide. And I was trying so hard now to be beautiful, to be attractive. You know, a woman's idea of what a man thinks is attractive, being thin. That's now, so that's where the cause of my anorexia. Trying so hard to be attractive. It doesn't make sense, sort of. But what was the real twist in the tale was the mother, listening to this, went hysterical, crying and sobbing. And see, the poor psychologist had two people, someone on a table, and the other one was just even worse. So, you know, I had to sort of take the young daughter out of hypnosis and then to deal with the mother, and then when he calmed the mother down, what's going on? And that's the point, she said, I was that sister. I never told my daughter that she had an aunt, because the aunt committed suicide, exactly as she said. And it was one of those secrets we kept in the family. And so, my sister who committed suicide got reborn as a man she loved, the daughter of that man, so she could be close to him. That was my sister, now my daughter. Life, soap operas, they are pretty much the same. Complicated. Intertwined. So that's what happens. So sometimes the anorexia, that physical problem, why? You find out exactly why. Why did they get reborn in this place? Why? So anyway, sometimes the emotions, the mind and the body are intertwined. So one of the things we do learn here is how we can deal with both and help them with simple meditation methods. Just like good old... I can say the names, Jippy and Lloyd. They were students over in Adelaide. And she was one who had anxiety disorder. Really bad anxiety disorder. So her anxiety disorder was so bad that despite all the doctors, three doctors, psychologists, nothing could get her out of bed. She was bedridden. And of course, the stuff which was going on in the studies was just, she couldn't even go to classes. And nothing working. Her uncle was a close disciple. I won't say who he is, because you know who he is. So he sort of told her to call me, and that was when I started telling her simple mindfulness and kindness. And how powerful that is. So I said to get her mindful, and also to get her to be take some charge over her treatment, because sometimes if people say this is what you do, this is what you should do, this is what you should do, then sometimes it just takes away your own sort of want of a better word, control over your own body. And sometimes you just feel that you're just a victim and you can do nothing to assist. So anyway, I told her, when you have a panic attack, how does it feel? Well, it feels anxious and not good enough. I want you to actually, 3 days' time, and you can call again and give a complete description of the feelings when you have a panic attack, what it feels like. Like you have to put like a 1,000-word essay. That's a lot of words, but she rose to the occasion. It gave her something to do. She had to describe the feelings. Not just it was anxious, but where it came from, how it developed, and how it dissipated. And she gave a big description. And I said, exactly where was it located? So in my chest, I said, I want coordinates. And I want extension. Is it round? Is it square? Is it diamond? Or how does it feel? Triangular? So for another 3 days, she gave this really good description of how it spread over her chest. Great. Now, whenever you have that, you're mindful now. That's a degree of mindfulness and clarity of just the physical feelings in her body. When she had a panic attack, it wasn't just it hurts, so it's anxious. She really had to investigate it and really get to know it. And afterwards, I said, well, next time you have a panic attack, just get your hand and massage the area. Kindness. Massage it. I said, if you feel so weak and tired that you can't do it, ask your boyfriend. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. And he didn't mind. I was a boy once. I know what boys like. So, and then give me a call in 3 days. And after 3 days, he called again. And he said, what happened? He said, I had a panic attack. I could feel it. I know exactly where it was. And then massage that area of my body. And I said, then what happened to the feeling? I said, when I massaged it, the physical feeling just dissipated. And then, what happened to the anxiety? And that was the pause. The light bulb. The eureka moment. That went too, she said. Great. Now you know how to deal with your anxiety. And I hung up. I'm a busy monk. I can't sort of linger around all the time once people have got enough info. So, she was out of bed within a few days. Anxiety disorder, she knew how to deal with it. Whenever it started to come up, she would massage the area and it would go away. The physical manifestation would be dealt with and the thing which caused it would also go too. The anxiety. So, she was out of bed, went back to university, completed her first class honours in dentistry, and of course, now for all the things I say about, marriage is suffering, I was really happy to be asked to be the monk who did the blessing for them in their marriage. They insisted, making sure I was in town, so I could actually do the marriage blessing for them, for GP and Lloyd. I've got a couple of kids now, so I told them we'd be suffering. Now they know. No, I know that. They're pretty happy. But it was a wonderful little story, and just how, when you have any anxiety, fear, grief, whatever is that problem which you have, instead of trying to fix it in your mental world, What does it feel like when you're grieving? Not just have a quick sort of, oh yeah, you feel sad. You feel, no, come on. The feelings in your body. Because sometimes I feel sorry for doctors and say, how are you feeling? It hurts. How does it hurt? Well, you know, it just hurts. Doesn't give you much information to go on. But for a person who really wants to be mindful, you really get to know the feelings. You examine them, explore them, get to know them. So you can actually describe to somebody, have the vocabulary, the experience, know exactly what it feels like. And give a big description of it. Imagine just how helpful that could be for a doctor, a medical practitioner. But anyway, once you know that grief, you can feel it, and you really know it well, exactly where in your body is it? You don't say just in the chest. Coordinates. Starting from your navel, your belly button. Up, the left, the right, circular, oval, oval this way or oval that way. Or is it somewhere else in your body? Or is it all over? Find out. That is a mindfulness exercise. You're aware of what grief feels like. Not just trying to get away from it, but really knowing it. And the next thing is, what makes it relax? What makes it feel less tight, tense? Even if necessary, give it a nice massage. Or cuddle a teddy bear. Does that relax the feeling? Okay. No, another one's doing it. Every time I do something weird, people actually get me doing a teddy bear. You know that just, we haven't, well, yeah, we shouldn't do it. There's enough nuns now, but some time ago, I was in Penang, and I was teaching the Australian walking meditation, the kangaroo walking meditation. And usually, I mean, it's been exploited. Please apologize for exploiting you. But, you know, there was no nuns to ask to do the walking meditation, so I did it myself. Boom, boom, boom. And as soon as I got up there, the handphones came out, and people started videoing it, which I didn't mind so much until they found it was put on YouTube. That is one of the most popular. I don't bother doing kangaroo walking meditation. Anyway, I don't mind. So, when you have this with whatever works for some grief, something physical, like anxiety or fear or whatever it is, oh, the two of you. And a massage or just a cuddle of a bear, whatever it is, sometimes that lessens and relieves the physical manifestation of grief. And when the physical manifestation goes, you're focusing on your body, it's body awareness, and the physical manifestation eases off and goes. And if someone were to ask you, how does your grief feel? It's not there. It's gone. That's how you learn. From physical, emotional, they come together. I'm coming over here. So the physical and the emotional. And these are all things we learn from our meditation practice. When you learn from here, this laboratory here, it's incredible the sort of stuff you learn and what you can do. And also those anxieties. You know, I don't know, well, maybe because I'm too busy, but the last time that, you know, in Australia we have these year 12 exams at the end of the year, November. No, that's from there you go to university. Or if you don't go to university, then what can you do? And to actually to motivate many of the young men and the young girls who are, you know, whose parents are Buddhist, I said, well, look, if you don't get to university, you can become a monk or a nun. And it's amazing how that motivates them to study more. But of course, it doesn't mean that all the monks and nuns are the same. No, I won't go there. But the one year, I was invited to the Jewish school, Carmel School in Perth, to actually to teach a little bit for the year 12s who were about to go into the tertiary entrance examinations. And I teach exactly what I teach here, even like getting to know your emotions as they manifest on the body, and especially if you're anxious and afraid before you go in. Get to know it first of all, and rub your tummies. Or whatever else eases that. Learning just how to... the cup is always heavy the longer you hold it. You put it down and rest. And a few minutes later when you pick it up, it's light again. So that before your exams, you don't pick up your books in the morning before the exam. Not even the night before, you know, you just have a good meal, favorite meal, good sleep. Don't sort of, if you want to listen to some music, fine, a movie, fine, but don't study. Just relax. It's preparing your mind, not worrying, letting that go, taking a bit of time off, putting down the main problem of your exams, so that when you pick it up and the paper's right in front of you, you're relaxed. And total stuff like that, general stuff which you hear here so many times. And I got the letter back from the, I actually saw it in the newspaper, that they have a list of top schools, you know, from the exams. And who got the number one school that year? Carmel School. And the principal sent me a letter. Thank you. Thank you very much for getting our school to number one this year. They didn't give a donation. Just thank you. That's nice anyway, that'll do. They never invited me back again. I don't know why. Anyway, that's the bad karma of not giving a donation, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, that meant that these things actually work. And now for your health. It's amazing just how many times, you know, I already mentioned I get invited over to, and other people get invited over to the cancer groups. They really work tremendously well. So you're learning a lot here, and you can't forget it. It's too powerful. So when you do go home, you will meditate, you can't avoid it. Maybe you put it off for a while, but then always come back. Someone once said that. They said, well, yeah, I heard these teachings, and I thought, I've got other things to do in my life. We keep coming back. Not because of the place or the people, because of the teachings. They're just too meaningful. So little by little you find out how to have a peaceful body, how to have peaceful relationships with partners. Just, I don't know how many times that first time, or one, not the first time, but this one time when I was invited by four couples in the Australian Embassy in Bangkok. I was really quite moved by the invitation. I said, okay, I'm going. Because what had happened is four couples, you know, expats, Australians, in the Australian Embassy in Bangkok, two had already divorced, two had separated, and they read my book, and there were four couples back together again. That's powerful stuff. Why? There's something in there for forgiveness, two bad bricks in a wall, open the door of your heart. Many stories in there, which are just the basic. What's important in life? Being right or being at peace? Which is the most important? So just, you look at your partner, and are they perfect? You can find all the faults in them, but then you look in the mirror and you say, I think we're a match. I'm just as bad as they are. It's wonderful just, you know, the time to let go. So let go of just always carrying around that past and those bad ideas of which the forgiveness ceremony, which is a great one, that just that every year, and I usually say just on your marriage anniversary, and where I remember this the most was I did a celebrity wedding once, and it was in, I think, New Idea. And New Idea was a glossy magazine, I think in Malaysia, because this was this TV star. And she got married to one of the producers or something, and I just happened to be in Malacca. I just happened to be there. So I said, oh, great, it's a bomb. Please, now come to do our blessing. So I did the blessing for them, and I got my picture in New Idea, glossy magazine, celebrity monk. Anyway, I don't know where that went a few years ago, but so afterwards, every now and again she sort of checks in, and she said, oh, we're still together. And he said, one of the things which really meant a lot to us was just every year on our anniversary, we remember you, and we do a little ceremony of asking forgiveness of one another, saying to one another, whatever we've done by body, speech, or mind, intentional, unintentional, or things I should have done, which I didn't do, forgot, sometimes on purpose, because, you know, I'm a human being, I get grumpy sometimes. I ask forgiveness, sincerely. And I'm a woman, I'm a guy, and sometimes I make mistakes, but I'm committed to this relationship. I love you, I care for you, please forgive me. And they say it with such meaning that the other person has to give forgiveness. And then the other way around, the other person forgives. So it means every year, anything which has been held from the past, which if you don't dispose of it, it just gets very stinky and fetid and putrid. It's let go of every year. And it's also the acknowledge the importance and the fact that people do make mistakes. Things like that, and they're still together, having a happy time. That sort of stuff is what you learn here. So it's not just getting enlightened. It's all this other stuff as well on the way, which is powerful and amazing. And that's actually why, whether you like it or not, that's how you practice when you go home. You can't forget it. Obviously, in your home, if you can find a little corner somewhere, which is your meditation corner, if you haven't got a shrine room. And the classic story hasn't been bettered yet. There's this couple, this Aussie couple, two little kids, boy and girl, their meditation space was under the stairs. And they, you know, they had a cupboard under the stairs, a two-story house. And they turned out into the meditation place. And they go there to meditate. And they said once there, probably happened many times since, and they had to come and tell me straight away because it was really cool, that there are two kids who weren't allowed in there because they were too noisy. But there are two kids, the boy and the girl. The girl was about 4 or 5. And they were playing outside, and the boy hit his sister. And the sister, just the first time she'd been struck by her brother, she couldn't process it emotionally. She just cried. And what did she do after bursting into tears? She ran into the house, under the stairs, the meditation place, where she sat down, just to get the peaceful energy so that she could find some ease and solace after the first time she was emotionally distraught. She didn't know what the place was, but she could feel it had this wonderful, warm, peaceful energy. So, those places do build up energy. Your kids feel it. Dogs feel it, for sure. So, they love sitting next to you if you're meditating, nice and quietly. So anyway, that's what you do when you get to wherever you go. If you can find a Dhamma center, fine. Well, if you can't, a nice quiet place. And it may not be the same energy as face to face, but at least all these talks, at least you can get the voice, you know, in front of you when you're sort of listening to the wonderful guided meditations of the Venerable Mu. And so it brings back all these wonderful memories of your time at Bodhinyana Monastery, Old Jhana Grove rather, on the Easter retreat. There's so much you can do. And of course, if you're lucky, there's other retreats, other places. Even it may not be by Ajahn Brahm. They are not disciples of Ajahn Brahm, clones of Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahmali. And all these other great monks and stuff. So that's actually what happens when you leave here. So I spent a lot of time talking about the deep meditation, getting you really, you know, as far as possible. But at the same time, it's not just about the path to enlightenment. The path to enlightenment and the path to peace in your world are one and the same paths. Just depending on which way it turns and how deep it goes. So off you go and have a wonderful meditation. Sadhu! 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 Very good. And please remember, if you do listen to any of the guided meditations or talks at home, when the guided meditation is finished, out of respect, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And the reason I do that, I said, is because sometimes the meditation can be just so dull. I mean, it's really good stuff, but you've got to give it some energy afterwards and put in context. A bit of joy, for goodness sake. My goodness, come on. Lazy bear. Okay, so now we have some interviews.